Welcome back to Get Wise, College Admissions Explained. I'm Arun Ponnasamy. We're continuing with the fundamental truths of college admissions here in Season 1. And for our second episode, we're discussing what you do is more important than what you study. I'm fired up to be joined by Nandita Gupta, a colleague here at CollegeWise. But for the purposes of our conversation today, she's a former high-level recruiter of corporate CEOs and a former Stanford admissions officer. When you throw in her background as a college counselor and a true counseling nerd, which you'll figure out very quickly, I've got the right person for this and at the right time. We had an awesome chat. And if you're looking for more information on what college admissions looks like specifically at this time, check out the webpage CollegeWise is set up to cover everything about how the coronavirus has impacted going to college. You can find it at collegewise.com/COVID. All right, let's dive in with Nandita. Nandita, out of curiosity, do you even remember the first time we met?
Oh, I sure do. I tell that story frequently.
Backstory for everyone, you know, I shared a little bit about her bio, but the backstory is we actually met at a government relations committee meeting in Sacramento for WACAC, the Western Association of College Admissions Counseling. And we got paired up in the same group.
We sure did. It was just the two of us. Yeah, and I was like, they put the two Indians together. Okay, I see how it is.
Yeah, exactly. And then it was kind of that awkward, I guess we have to become friends. And then I think you were a little distrustful of me until I revealed I had that small bit in Meet the Patels.
Yes, yes.
So here in season one of Get Wise, we've really decided to focus on this idea of universal truths. With all these changes taking place in the world around us and, you know, in admissions, which is what we do here at CollegeWise, there are still some things that are just going to absolutely hold true, no matter what might change in terms of standardized testing requirements or dates and deadlines for various parts of the process. And one of those universal truths, the one we're going to tackle today, is what you do is more important than what you study. And I think, you know, for a lot of students out there, there can be, you know, some are absolutely, I want to do real estate and I'm going to go get a degree in real estate. And some know I want to become a physical therapist or a poet. But the vast majority of students out there don't have a clear sense necessarily of where they want to head. I think there's a lot of data out there showing it's something like 80% of the jobs that people would do in 20 years don't exist right now.
Absolutely.
Probably don't have that number exactly right, but you know, the larger point is, you know, is there. What you do is more important than what you study. So you worked at Stanford, and Stanford's a university, you know, there's a broad array of courses, majors, programs available to students. As you were looking, as you were evaluating these applications, how fixated were you on what the student marked off on, you know, page one of, here's what I think I'm going to study? Did that ever prove to be the make and break on your decisions?
Well, it's a factor like everything else is a factor. Most of the time, it did not play a huge role because most, I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but a good 40 to 50% of the class comes in pre-med. At Stanford, we see basically the other half feels computer science. So we knew that these majors were going to change, that these students, you know, and this is the shame, really, is that we don't give our children, our high schoolers, a real good look at what are the different kinds of jobs out there. And so they only know these very siloed type professions. And they think, okay, well, if I want to be a responsible adult, then I should major in either pre-med or computer science or something like that. And
right.
So we did not pay it much mind. Now, that being said, when you see a student who is truly someone who's very passionate about the classics and has studied Latin all throughout 4 years and started taking Greek on their own or is interested in studying Greek in college and wants to be a classics major, that can impact the decision because, you know, we are looking for students. We're looking for a diverse pool of students, and therefore we want all disciplines represented in our incoming class. And so I would say the vast majority of time, it doesn't make a difference because they're choosing sort of the standard majors that everyone is choosing. But when a student makes it really clear about what they're truly passionate about, and what they're passionate about is something that we need on our campus, sure, it can make a difference.
So I have to ask you, like, not go any deep. So is it easier to get in if you want to be a classics major?
It's not easier to get in. I think because, again, you have to showcase that compelling fit with the university. Anyone can just say, like, oh, I want to study medieval history. Well, what have you shown in your past that suggests a passion for that? Where can you point to that? So that's important, obviously. You can't just pull something out of thin air. And then the other thing is, you still have to be a fit for the university. This just helps us understand what kind of impact you might have in the classroom, because we know what you might be interested in studying and how you would impact our classrooms. And so I would not say that it's easier, but it is easier for the admission officer to imagine your role on campus.
No, and this is actually a great time to kind of reference back to episode one, which was really focused on the idea of there is no formula. So, absolutely. You know, any students, parents, counselors who are advising students, you know, this idea that there's like, quote unquote, an easier major that will get you into, you know, selective, moderately selective, certainly not highly selective colleges. That's something we need to kind of put to rest, because as Nandita noticed, that's so much of this is about that larger narrative that, you know, as we've talked about previously, authenticity and being the best version of yourself and things of that. So let's get back a little bit to, you know, how we're advising actually students to think about this. You know, if you had a ninth grader and, you know, you and I, as we both acknowledge, Chicago was very similar. I would say probably half the kids were coming in pre-med, right? And it really meant nothing more than, hey, people in my community who are bright and talented and living comfortable lives, they seem to be doctors. That seems to be a great trajectory. And so they were, many students were just unaware of what the rest of the world, what possibilities lay in front of them. For a ninth grader, what's the way in which you start getting them exploring? As you noted, we don't do a great job here in the States. You know, internships, you know, apprenticeships are almost like frowned upon, you know, in a lot of communities that they're heralded in other parts of the world. Here, they're kind of seen as like, well, if you can't do school, you should go get an apprenticeship, right? Mm-hmm. How do we get students at a young age, you know, 8th, 9th, 10th grade, starting to kind of build some vision of who they want to become and, you know, what they might want to study? And then, of course, we'll link it to careers later. But let's start with this idea of like what education might, how do they start exploring that?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I actually do think that career exploration can even start in an age-appropriate way in 8th, 9th, 10th grade. And I tell my students all the time, talk to the adults in your life, all the adults you come across. What do you do? What education did you need to get to where you are? What do you like about what you do? What are some of the challenges that your field faces? And then you can kind of see, you know, what interests you, and you just learn that there are more jobs out there other than businessman, doctor, lawyer, you know, right. And you start to see, oh, the adults in my life do so many different things. And then as you get older, they turn from sort of casual conversations to what we call informational interviews, where you actually, meeting with someone, and you're approaching it with the right attitude of coming prepared with questions. You need to have a clear idea of what information you're seeking from that person. And you know that you're going to steer the conversation about helping you learn more about what this person does. So I do think that career exploration starts at a young age and continues throughout the career of an individual, including when you're in your mid-20s, early 30s, mid 30s, maybe even mid 40s, informational interviews are a very important way of learning about what exists out there and how you might see yourself fitting in.
Right. And I think even interviews, I know where you're coming from. I think just conversations, right?
Exactly.
I think, you know, I think back to, you know, my high school days, maybe that's what jammed me up. I my dad was a doctor. All his friends were doctors. Mm-hmm. And if I met anyone else, they were kind of a banker. So I had like very little vision of, you know, I did that Morgan Stanley internship the summer after freshman year of college, just because that was the only thing I knew. Right. Yeah, and then absolutely. You find yourself maturing a bit and kind of talking to other folks and like, whoa, there's all these other possibilities out there that just aren't there at the surface level.
Exactly.
I think we probably have gotten better as a little bit better in schools. And I think the internet probably has opened up, you know, vision. Though now so many students want to become influencers. I don't know what to tell many of these students.
I mean, to your point that the jobs that are in demand 20 years from now don't even exist right now. I mean, I would argue social media is a field that's burgeoning right now that is a yep. legitimate career for people that yep. nobody could have imagined 20 years ago.
I still can't imagine it.
I still can't imagine it.
It's real. But no, but I mean, social media is something that I think generationally a lot of adults would poo-poo. Mm-hmm. But I think about a student I worked with several years ago from Vietnam who, you know, she dabbled in photography. She loved food, had become a kind of foodie at a young age. And she found herself traveling around Ho Chi Minh City, taking photographs of street carts, the street cart vendors and the food and the vendors. And then she found herself, she's an extrovert, found herself talking to these people and came to realize a lot of them were coming from outer rural communities into the city, and they were bringing their own distinct forms of cuisine. And so she moved beyond just taking the picture to doing these mini little interviews. And then she would document these all on Instagram. And she developed this wild following to the point where other restaurants started noticing that people were coming to her for the recs on like, mm-hmm. what's the next wave and great food coming to Ho Chi Minh City. Right. And so she became this influencer, but she was so savvy about it. Restaurants were kind of reaching out to her saying, hey, if we brought you and three of your best friends in this weekend, would you be willing to take some photographs? We'll comp you on your food, you know? And she'd be like, great. And so she was eating at the finest restaurants mm-hmm. in Saigon and, you know, kind of developed a clear sense of communication and business. I mean, she was wheeling and dealing. In the end, she was charging people for the right for her to come in and talk about their restaurant, right? And that is social media. I still remember speaking with her mom. Her mom was saying, oh, she Instagrams. And I remember thinking, like, what kind of skill set is Instagramming? And then, you know, putting aside my own silly biases, you come to realize, oh my, in this world, it's everything. Someone who's really savvy with Instagram can pretty much flip that in a dozen different ways.
Every business takes their social media strategy, and they use the word strategy because it is, that's the appropriate word, that yep. you need to have a strategy on social media. Otherwise, you will be left behind as a business. Right. You know and what I love? Go ahead.
No, please.
What I love about the story about your student is that she took something she loved and was able to figure out a need that existed in the world, a problem she could solve, and therefore something that she could get paid for. When I was traveling last year through Japan, I learned this concept of ikigai. Are you familiar with this?
I am not.
It's a Japanese
concept. But I want to hear
concept.
More, definitely.
Yeah, it's a Japanese concept that means like a reason for being, basically. And what it is it's the belief that everyone has an ikigai. It's just a matter of finding it for yourself. And it's a confluence of what you love, what the world needs, what you're good at, and what you can get paid for. And those four things coming together is your ikigai, your reason for being. And I think the reason why I tell my students that it's important to play to your strengths when it comes to your major, when it comes to your career choice, is because that is the way that you can ultimately get on the path to finding your ikigai. If you are neglecting what you love, then that one cornerstone piece of ikigai is missing, and you will never quite reach finding your ikigai.
I knew we would go in many directions. I didn't realize Eastern philosophy would be one of them, but I appreciate it. But no, it makes so much sense. You know, you and I go out and speak at a lot of high schools, and you know that conversation where the parent comes up to you and says, listen, I heard everything you said about authenticity, pursuing your passion, your curiosity, but he loves video games. Oh, and you know, as someone who enjoys video games, that's a portal to like a dozen worlds.
It sure is. And even just a world in and of itself. I remember an applicant to Stanford University who we ultimately ended up admitting, who as a 17-year-old boy loved video games, which is not an uncommon character trait, but started blogging about his video game experiences. And his blog gained popularity, and it came to the point where the video game makers would release their games to him first so that he could play them and review them. And then his followers would, you know, learn more about the games, and that's how, and he started making money off that blog, actually. And so here's someone taking their passion, yes, for video games, something that seems like there's no future, and creating an opportunity out of it that really served him quite well.
Right. I know. I think a lot of parents hear gaming and they think, you know, oh, esports, there's no future. And yeah, there's a small percent. But for so many kids, video games, there's graphic design, there's programming. It can be a portal to neuroscience and marketing and
surgery.
Surgery, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we know the military hires these young gamers to, you know, fly drones and, you know, do surveillance and things of that sort. So let's, I'd love to dive. You've got such a like great way of talking about the world. I'd like to turn a little bit inwards. And when you went to Princeton, did you know you were going to study anthropology? I knew when I was going to Chicago, anthropology was my plan, but I actually thought I was going to do archaeology. Like I went there because Indiana Jones, literally, that was my college decision-making process. Was Indiana Jones was based on a University of Chicago professor. So that's terrible. Students don't make your decisions like that. But did you know you were going to study anthropology?
You know, I did and I didn't. I had loved linguistics. I also thought I loved linguistics growing up. I didn't know it as like an official field. I didn't. It just was, words were just cool to me, and the evolution of words, that was just interesting to me. And I always loved learning about etymologies. But I didn't think that was like a field of knowledge, really. And in fact, when I, you know, you said half the class comes in as pre-med because they think, oh, your parents are doctors and their friends are doctors. I thought I was doing it a little bit different because I was going to major in chemistry instead of biology. and I was actually drawn to medicine, not so much because of my parents, because I was a little bit of a defiant teenager, but more so because I was under the false belief that people say, you're good at science, you like helping people, you should be a doctor. Turns out there are many, many different things that you can do if you like science and like helping people that is not going straight into medicine. But I didn't know that at the time. And so I thought I would major in chemistry, but I took my first anthropology class my freshman spring, and that changed everything. And I just remember thinking, I was like, oh my goodness, this is a discipline? You can study this? Like the stuff that I love to think about just on my own and figure out and notice, you know, sort of anecdotally, that was actually a discipline. I was thrilled. And so I very quickly changed my major to anthropology and honestly never looked back because it really was everything I dreamt it to be. And I'll tell you, you know, people would say when I was working in investment banking, like, oh, what are you going to do with that anthropology degree? Or before I worked in banking or once I was in banking, like, oh, you're really putting that anthropology degree to use. And I say, yes, I am. I use that degree every single day. When you're talking about, I firmly believe, what is anthropology, right? We know how to study a culture, how to make sense of something completely foreign, how to forge connections, how to find meaning in a situation. That is the ethnographer's craft, right? Understanding details and context and nuance, these are skills that serve you in every single setting. When I was in investment banking, it helped me understand the culture of the trading room, the culture of the investment bank. I credit it with being part of my success, honestly, helping understand what the client's needs are. When I was in admissions, you have to do a lot of training about bias training and helping admission officers understand that they need to check their biases so as they don't come into play when they're admitting students or denying them. And an admission officer and an ethnographer or an anthropologist is a person who understands how do you recognize your own cultural implicit biases, you know, and how do you make sure that they're not coming into play, and how can you try to be an impartial observer, even though that's, and the ethnographer knows that's actually an impossible task, but you strive towards it. And then when I was in executive search, I was able to sum up a company's culture very quickly, able to assess who would be a cultural fit for the company. So I really feel like and now when I work with students, it's really about helping them find their story, thinking about what makes them tick, thinking about their right. cultural fit with an institution. So I believe that I use my anthropology degree every single day of my life. And I feel that's the best thing a major can do for you, is be something that you kind of rely upon, or maybe is the lens through which you view the world, regardless of what you're actually looking at.
Right. No, I find myself drawing on it daily. I think just earlier today on a webinar, I was referencing the idea of the risks that come with viewing college admissions as just a ritual. I'm now 17, mm-hmm. I'm now 18, I've graduated from high school. I must now continue with four mm-hmm. more years of advanced education with no clear sense of purpose, you know, or vision of where it could lead you. Mm-hmm. And it's so much more different when a kid gives themselves time to pause and reflect. And obviously we could go down a whole path there. And well, I think you're highlighting something that, you know, there can be anxiety for parents, you know, particularly in a time where the economy is struggling, that the degrees have to be useful. Mm-hmm. Make an argument, you know, can you make an argument that there's no such thing as a useless degree?
I absolutely can. See, here's what I will say. And again, as somebody who worked in executive search, I will say, I think we assign too much importance to that major, to that degree. Majors mm-hmm. matter, but skills matter more. And I think what people need to understand is that there are real skills that come with liberal arts degrees. It's easy for us to think, okay, they come with engineering and they come with computer science, they come with business and accounting. But these competencies that come with liberal arts degrees are also just as valuable. And in fact, I'll tell you, the students gain skills with liberal arts degrees. They need to learn how to market them. I think the problem is that sometimes these skills feel so innate to the students, so they're less resume worthy, quote unquote, but that's simply not true. I think about that and I, you know, for example, here's a skill: defending a point of view in writing. That mm-hmm. is a skill that many people do not have. But I'll tell you, a student who majored in English, who majored in history, who majored in philosophy, who majored in anthropology, is going to have that skill down pat. An example of this from tech, in fact, Jeff Bezos, who runs Amazon, starts every single meeting of his. If you want to have a meeting with him, you first start by writing a 1 to 2 page memo of exactly what you want to discuss. Mm-hmm. And he spends the first 15 minutes of your meeting reading that memo. Everybody sits down around the table and reads the memo that you have prepared. And so writing skills are so crucial in that situation. The discipline of writing forces you to think through every detail. There's no hand waving. There's no half finished thoughts. You really have to put everything down to pen and paper, but I would say cursor to page, I guess. That's a skill that is extremely valued. Here's another skill: understanding implicit biases. We live in the age of data, but data is meaningless without context, and understanding what decisions are made in order to understand that data. That's something that liberal arts majors are very good at doing. Another skill: comfort in ambiguity. Facebook says in its hiring process that they're looking for people who are comfortable working with ambiguity. Who are these people? Oftentimes, they're not the engineers who are drawn to engineering because of that lack of gray, that black and white. You know what the answer is. If you do the calculations correct, they yield an answer. Well, I'll tell you, the sociology majors, the political science majors, they're very comfortable working in ambiguity and shades of gray. And implicitly, these companies are asking for these majors. So there are no useless majors or useless degrees. It's just about learning, really being critical in evaluating the skills that come with each degree and marketing those skills. Believe it or not, employers are looking for skills, not for majors. They don't care about your major. They care about the skills that you bring to their job.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if we look at data, you know, labor market data, you will see philosophy majors are being hired broadly across not just, you know, working in, you know, writing or advertising and things of that sort, but they're being hired at banks. They're being hired at computer science, you know, computer companies, technology firms. This idea, you know, it's easy to be dismissive of, you know, gender studies, for example. Mm-hmm. I can hear snarky comments, but if that student has developed, you know, critical thinking skills, communication skills, all the things that you talked about, they're going to be viable in the marketplace. You know, I mean, that's in fact one of the criticisms of a number of computer science programs and business school programs are revamping, reinventing themselves. Because what they found is they're able to teach in a very specific way to what's happening right now. Mm-hmm. But with as dynamic as technology, as dynamic as the business worlds are, that what they teach those kids gets kind of just overrun very, very quickly. And those kids don't end up having the skill sets, right? So they're finding they have to teach the kids a little bit more broadly than just learn this program or just learn, you know, this mathematical modeling on how real estate or entrepreneurship. So Nandita, we've been talking a lot about, you know, what you're studying in college, you know, maybe that formal classroom engagement. And that, of course, can tie itself into major, which you and I both agree, as does all the data, that your major has less impact than most people assume on success. What about the ways in which students are learning outside of that classroom? Can you talk a little bit? You've been tied into a couple universities, and of course, in the search world, you're looking at those skills, but not all those skills are being developed right in the classroom. Can you talk about the ways in which outside the classroom, these kids are enriching their lives and their skill sets?
Absolutely. And this is what I advise my students all the time. If they're actually concerned about their career prospects, then what they need to be doing is not worrying about their major. In their major, they need to be studying hard. They need to be doing well in their classes. They need to be learning and learning and learning. But outside the classroom, they need to get involved. You know, I think even as a recent grad, you should have work experience, whether it's an internship, whether it's a part-time job, whether it's, you know, it could be work over the summer, it could be managing a club on campus, you know, paid, unpaid, whatever it takes. And the truth is, even if no one will hire you, you can even get work experience as a volunteer. That counts as well. Taking on a major responsibility in extracurricular clubs absolutely count. I'm convinced that a student of mine got a job in asset management on the strength of the fact that she managed a $10,000 budget for her a cappella group. And, mm-hmm. you know, this is the kind of work experience you can get outside of the classroom that actually is what hiring managers are looking for.
Right. And so even this idea that everything is going to come down to that major just doesn't hold true. I think most mm-hmm. of the most dynamic candidates that I would see on the admissions side, and certainly I expect when you were on the recruitment side, were bringing in skills that they, you know, from, as you noted, from the a cappella choir or from being on the soccer team, right? I mean, even to a certain extent in the world of college admissions, even as we admitted students who were former athletes, we knew most of them weren't going to play on our varsity athletic programs, mm-hmm. but they were bringing in particular skills
exactly.
that we knew would be valuable with the various organizations, with our culture, the community. You know, people need to understand that skills tend to be transitive, right? So you can take them from one arena in your life to another one. So we know a lot of the parents and the students kind of listening in on this podcast, Get Wise, are now thinking about, you know, how should I think about this in terms of admissions, right? And they're thinking about, like, what do I do for my, how should I think about my summer? How should I think about the extracurriculars when school fires back up? And some of that's changed a little bit where we might be thinking about it virtually, but what are some of the things that you're encouraging kids to think about as they explore things that might not be directly linked to a career or a major?
Again, I think it comes back, use the exact right word, explore. Especially in the years before college and including the years of college are meant for exploration. You know, that's actually what drew me back to working with students after I worked with adults for so many years, because I think when I was working with CFOs and CEOs, they're not so much into exploration. They have 30 years of experience. They know exactly what they want. But 17-year-olds, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds, 20-year-olds should be exploring. And that really is letting their curiosity drive them. And I think, you know, really what colleges are looking for, what employers are looking for, are similar in that these are the skills that will serve you for life. Things like grit, rigor, impact, polish, teamwork, ownership, curiosity. These are the things that you want to explore, and these are the things that you want to develop in yourself. And these are the things that will serve you well. The details of how exactly you do it matter less. So to that end, always follow your curiosity. Good things always come from making thoughtful decisions about why you chose to do something because you were motivated for a particular reason. And if that yeah. reason is your curiosity, that will serve you well for the rest of your life. I'll tell right. you when I, one of the first things that we do when we're interviewing a candidate, and I worked with CEOs and CFOs. One of the first things that we do when we work with a candidate is having them tell us why they made the decisions throughout their career that they made. And that is the, it's less about which decision they made and much more about why they chose to do, to take the turns that they did. And I think that's the same philosophy we need to bring to our students, which is why are you choosing to do this thing that you want to do? It matters less what you are choosing to do, but much more why you're choosing to do it, and to be able to explain that and your reasoning behind that.
Yeah, no, I think I'm always reminded of the Steve Jobs commencement at Stanford, where he mm-hmm, talks about you mm-hmm. can only connect the dots going backwards, which I know leads some people to think about how can I connect those dots going backwards, you know, but really what he's making the argument for is that idea of just pursuing the things that you love doing. Like, I loved calligraphy. So he continued to study calligraphy even mm-hmm. after he dropped out of Reed College, which led to that graphic user interface that made Macintoshes and Apples so distinct from the PC world. Mm-hmm. And of course led to them being, you know, one of the most successful companies in the history of the world. And I know that's hard and probably even a little bit scary for a lot of parents who may have come from a more traditional background of securing mm-hmm. their career and their job. But when we look at some of the most successful people out there, they are people who have taken some risks. And I think you probably, I think both of us have referenced both careers and internships that didn't quite work out. There's a lot of value in that too.
Absolutely.
You know, there's so much value in that internship that just bombs out.
Not to mention that you learn skills whether something worked out for you or didn't. Investment banking was never my passion. It was never going to be the thing that I did for decades. But did I learn skills there that I continue to use today? Absolutely. And that's what that's what I really emphasize for my students. Focus on the skills that you're getting in whatever step that you're in, and take those skills with you, no matter whether you change your mind about what you're actually doing or not. You have to be mindful of the skills that you're gaining at all times. I think that is what distinguishes somebody who's ultimately successful in their career versus somebody who really can't connect those dots because they're not focusing on acquiring skills.
Yeah, I'm now having these flashbacks to a summer in high school spent as an encyclopedia salesperson. Mm. I loved encyclopedias. I thought I liked sales. The two of them together didn't work out quite as well. So
But think about it now. You have an encyclopedic knowledge of college admissions. And yeah, you are, you know, I think everybody is a little bit in sales and that they have to represent themselves really well. They have to get other people's buy-in. That is sales. Yeah. And that is a skill set that serves every single person well.
Yeah, I've actually heard a lot of really, you know, I live and work in Los Angeles, and I have the opportunity to speak to a lot of very successful people in the world of entertainment in Hollywood. And I'm struck by how few of them, you know, are recommending that your sole focus needs to be on just like the technical aspects of acting or filmmaking or producing or writing. You know, so many of them, it's easy to dismiss the folks who work as, you know, servers at restaurants or bartenders at bars, but the skill set, the skills that you pick up, if I have one regret in my like career trajectory, is that I've never been in the service industry, right? Mm-hmm. But talking to people who are very successful CEOs, CFOs, running their own businesses, so many will draw upon those experiences when they were 16 to 25 and having to just get out there and be on their feet all day and communicating with people on, you know, they might have had a bad day, but if they wanted to get that tip, they had to read the room, recognize the situation, react appropriately. Those are all skills that are going to be valuable regardless of what career you head into.
One of my favorite facts that I learned from my time in executive search is, I don't know if you know this, but 40% of Fortune 500 CEOs have liberal arts degrees. And that is not surprising at all to me, because leadership accrues to those who understand humanity best. And whether it's because you were a server, you interact with people and you really understand, what are my customers' pain points? How am I solving? It's not just, people are not equations, you know? And so I recommend to all my students, I think that STEM-focused students should be taking liberal arts courses. And I think that liberal arts students should be taking an econ class, should be taking a statistics class. These are how you understand the other modes of thinking, which are ultimately what make you a successful leader. And that is what the world is thirsty for.
Right.
And I'll tell you another funny thing is, whenever I spoke to CEOs, those who were business majors or CS majors or accounting majors, whatever, they always said, everything I learned on the job. And my job training was the most important thing that I've received. Everyone who was a liberal arts major will always say that they firmly believe that being a liberal arts major gave them some keen insight, some special advantage or perspective that contributed to their success. So I thought that was always really fascinating.
Right. Well, and the numbers don't lie. I mean, they're, you know, even, you know, I worked at Caltech, and that was very in that STEM world. When you take a look at where do students go when they get their PhDs in the physical sciences, where have they spent their undergraduate years? And number one, when we look at those like National Science Foundation, you know, data sets, yeah, Caltech's number one, Harvey Mudd, another great math science institution, is number two. But then at, you know, the rest of the list, number three is Reed College, a quintessential liberal arts college. You know, slots 6 through 10 are places Carleton, Grinnell, Kenyon, right? The schools that don't show up on there, Princeton, Chicago, Berkeley, Stanford, places that everyone heralds for the physical sciences, mm-hmm. but it's not the only path to, you know, learn it at a very deep level. There can be pretty magical things happening within these larger, smaller, you know, liberal arts environments. And I think that tends to get overlooked. There are some students who are listening. They know exactly what they want to do. Right. They mm-hmm. want to study finance. They've done the hard work. They've done the exploring starting at a young age, and they've developed a clear vision, and they're going to apply to programs specific to what they want to study. What advice do you have for them as they kind of, you know, not only think about the applications and the story they want to tell, but also as they plan their extracurriculars in their summers? What advice would you have for them?
I think, again, it's about leaning into your strengths. You know, if you know what your passions are, which you're lucky to have that be the case if you are 17 years old, and that's certainly not the expectation, then lean into those strengths and learn more. I feel very strongly that a student should, I mean, my personal philosophy is lean into your strengths and bolster your weaknesses. So always be aware if you are that finance head, absolutely pursue that path. That is your passion. That is where your what your heart beats for. That is what you should do. But how can you bring in other skill sets that will make you a better finance professional? You know, and so starting to think about taking, I think, getting involved there also. Tips that I tell my students all the time, get involved with your career services office, or go early and often. I tell students all the time, many students wait until the end of their senior year. That is a mistake. Start as early as the second semester of your freshman year. These are where they're going to have those. This is where you're going to get that exposure to learn, what am I passionate about? You know, for those students who don't know what their passion is. For those students who do, still get involved with your career services office, because they will have the opportunities for you that you can take advantage of to learn exactly where you fall within your passion about what you want to study.
Now, that's amazing. So we were joking earlier, you know, parents of Indian immigrant parents. And the reality was I had a certain privilege in that my folks said, Arun, go off and study what you want. Mm-hmm. You know, like they had developed some sense of like, if he goes out and does what, you know, he enjoys, good things will happen. And I think by and large, they were correct. But, mm-hmm. you know, some families, there might still be some parents, they look at some of these price tags associated with college and what the job market looks like, and they might feel a little bit resistant. Do you have any final bits of advice for those parents as they kind of think about like, okay, how do I let my kid get out there, explore, or how do I, you know, just open my sense of what their future paths might look? What would you share here as we kind of bring things to a close?
I think that's a nuanced conversation, because the truth is if you major in whatever you want, it's possible that your first job may earn less than if you were to major in certain majors that aren't as lucrative right out the gate. But over the arc of your career, liberal arts majors do catch up and even sometimes overtake. But you're exactly right. Not everyone has that luxury of waiting. They took out enormous amounts of loans to get that BA. They need to help their families immediately. And in fact, I even feel like I took my job in investment banking partially because I wanted the financial freedom that came with that big paycheck, even though it wasn't what the work that made my heart sing. It was the work that gave me financial freedom. And that's important, I think, especially as a first gen or a student who comes from a humble background. I think even if you major in quote unquote a safer major, make sure that you're taking the other types of classes to balance you out. One of the beautiful things about the American college system is that you're taking, you know, 32, 34 classes, which means one third of them go towards your major. One third, depending on the school, might go towards a distribution requirement. And that leaves that last third, almost 11 or 12 classes, for kind of whatever you want to take. So you can really balance yourself out and still take a safer route if that is something that your family circumstances or personal circumstances necessitate. I'm not here to say that, you know, everyone can be a fine arts major. You know, some students do need to earn a job immediately out the gate where they are making money so they can pay back their loans. And I'm very sensitive to that. But I say that I think that there's room to do it all. And remember, even if your first job is not your final job, that you're learning skills in that job that you will apply no matter where you end up.
Wow. I want to thank you for bringing that kind of wealth of wisdom to this conversation. And for those of you who are out there listening, I hope you can take the advice that Nandita shared to heart. I think it's, you know, we say there is no formula, but she is definitely giving everyone out there a clear sense of how these career paths can unfold. And they're not directly linked to major. They're not directly linked to the prestige or selectivity of a university. They're ultimately going to be linked to the student and what kinds of skills and strengths they develop during their college years. So thank you so much. And just remember, it's what you do.
Thank you so much, Arun.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks again, Nandita, for sharing your thoughtful advice and for giving me a chance to reminisce about Meet the Patels. And most importantly, for making me Google Ikigai. Next week on Get Wise, we'll tackle another fundamental truth of college admissions. Community service is not about the hours. A reminder for those who want more advice on admissions in the time of Corona, go to collegewise.com/COVID. Thanks for listening, and may you all find your reason for being.